from here it grew. Now we have a meeting here in Santa Rosa every night. It grew from here, from Santa Rosa over to Napa. From Napa, from Santa Rosa to Mendocino. From Mendocino over to Eureka. And all the way up to Northern California. So, we are kind of proud of this thing that we started as AA here in the northern part of California. Of these six people, two of them went to their rewards. Walter Harbord and Walter Rand. One of them lives in, what's the name?
Tara Linda.
And he's a very old man and he couldn't come. But we have one man here. He's a charter member of this group. Frank, will you stand up? And all the others that started that group done wonderful. They're all sober now and doing a good job. The second wonderful thing that can happen to us here is we have a speaker here that I consider the best in the United States. I heard him twice and I know what he's talking about. He talks AA and he lives AA. I never heard, the first time I heard him, that's quite a few years ago, I couldn't get what he said because I wasn't quite, couldn't understand everything he said. I was kind of dumb in my head yet. Also, I think I'm a little older than he was. But the second time, he was terrific as far as I'm concerned. So I'm very proud to give you Dr. Earl tonight. Dr. Earl.
I don't know what I'm getting this in here for. I don't know what I really need this thing for. Need this. Well, how are you? One of the finest speakers in the United States, he says. This reminds me of, do all of you here know Chuck Chamberlain?
Oh, yeah.
Well, one time, Chuck and I were going the rounds and speaking, and one night, can you hear me there in the back?
Not very well.
Not very well, huh? Oh, this is for that, huh?
And,
yeah,
for the other.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Huh? Can you hear now?
Yeah.
Well, we were making the rounds, and one night, I would be chairman and Chuck would talk, and the next time it would be reversed. So we had a friend named Vic Maloney, remember Vic, in Sacramento. And Vic asked us up there, and we had been in Los Angeles, so we flew to Sacramento. Can you hear all right?
Yeah.
And when I had some of my clothes in Chuck's bag, when we got there, a bottle of shaving lotion had burst en route. So we had to put these clothes on with all this smell. So Vic arrived at the hotel door, and he walked in the room, and he stopped, and he said, "Are you sure you fellas want to talk tonight?" And so Chuck said, "Oh, ye of little faith, you know." And so that night I was chairman and Chuck talked, and at the end of the talk, a woman, a little old woman, came up to the podium And she looked up at Chuck and at me, and she grasped our hands. And she said, "I've heard all of them. I've heard Churchill, and I've heard Roosevelt, and I've heard Gandhi, but you two are the greatest." So Chuck and I floated down the aisle, you know, to the door. And as we got to the door, there was a little drunk there who was just wobbling from side to side, and he said, he looked up at Chuck, and he looked up at me, and he said, "Say, why don't you two guys change your pitch? You're keeping me drunk." Well, the greatest speaker in the United States is now here. You can all go out and get drunk. Well, I didn't really know what I was to talk on, but they drew straws here, and I have to give this blackboard talk again. God almighty. This is the 9 millionth time I've given the blackboard talk. But anyway, here you are. Now, as long as we're going to talk about these aspects of alcoholism, let's say this, that we could talk on the psychological aspects of alcoholism. But I'm not going to talk on that aspect of alcoholism tonight, really. Maybe I'll have a few words to say at the end. We'll see kind of how it comes out. Nonetheless, let's agree that the psychological aspect, the psychological maybe even causation of alcoholism, I'm not going to discuss. Then the spiritual aspects, I could talk about the spiritual aspects, and so could you, on alcoholism, but I'm not going to talk about that. We could talk on the spiritual aspects of any disease. I don't care if it's an acute appendicitis. We could speak about these aspects. Two aspects, the spiritual and the psychological, allow me the privilege of not discussing in detail. Maybe we'll touch here and there, but that's all. But I am going to talk then on the physical aspects of alcoholism, and that's all. The physical aspects. What occurs to you and to me, and what has occurred to you and to me, so that we have become victims of alcohol? Be that victimization very little, be it a medium, or be it a lot. Now, before you can understand alcoholism, you have to realize that alcoholism is not predominantly an emotional disease. Now, the reason I say that is that we are just barely emerging from the era where it was felt that all of alcoholism was simply an emotional cover-up. This is not true. As a matter of fact, there are many non-alcoholics who have emotional problems that will put the ordinary alcoholic to shame. And they can drink or not as they see fit. Now, this is not true of the alcoholic. So alcoholism is a physical disease. It's a disease of metabolism, an error in metabolism, so the authorities say. Now, we cannot understand alcoholism without a second point, and that is until we realize that the pain of staying sober, I'm talking about our drinking years now, the pain of staying sober was far in excess of our pain of drinking until the last 15% or maybe even 25% of our drinking years, where everything was all a mess then. It was all a mess. We hear amongst the non-alcoholics, and unfortunately we hear at many AA meetings, people who say, "The things that I did and the things that I thought when I was drinking were terrible." They enlarge on these. You see, this is really beside the point. It's the thoughts and the things that we do when we are undrunk. When we are sober, these are the things that fundamentally count, you see. So the pain of staying sober is miserable, and I am now briefly speaking about the psychological aspects of alcoholism. Now, if we were not alcoholics and set up to become alcoholics, we could easily take a few drinks and get rid of that pain. But this didn't happen to us successfully. So there's an added factor, and that's the physical factor, and that's what I want to talk about. Now, what I'm going to say about alcoholism will sound as though it were pat, were round, it were solid, and finished. Now, if we have the authorities of alcoholism in this room, and incidentally, I am not an authority on alcoholism. Yes, I'm a doctor, but I'm engaged in a surgical specialty. I don't treat alcoholics, and I'm not interested in treating alcoholics. But if we had all the authorities here, everything that I say, a certain percent of them would stand up and say, no, that's not true. And another percent would stand up and say, yes, it is. And there would be a constant fight on every sentence that I say. So realize then that what I have to say is simply a cross-section of what seems to be current opinion. Now, most of the authorities agree that we are either born with or indeed acquire over the course of time a physical difference when compared to the non-alcoholic. And this has been described by the medical profession as what's known as the X factor. Now, the X factor is nothing new. We used to talk about the X factor in diabetes. So we didn't know why the diabetic could not handle sugar. In 1922 or 3, two very famous physiologists, Banting and Best in Montreal, Canada, by a series of miraculous experiments, discovered that the disease of diabetes rests in an error in the function of the pancreas, a gland here that rests just below the stomach. And then the X factor was dropped. So the X factor is a rather common thing to be used in medical science. It's certainly simple, but it's what we use. This really means we don't really know. About 35 to 40% perhaps of alcoholics are born with a tendency to develop alcoholism. We find this in family histories. So-and-so's mother, father, grandfather, so on, seems to be an hereditary tendency. Now, this doesn't mean that all of us who have children, that they are going to grow up to be alcoholics at all. But maybe the odds are on their side that they might, but not very great, I suppose, because this is certainly disproven. Probably the rest, maybe 70% of alcoholics, acquire a certain physical difference as the time goes by. Let me just mention a few things. It said the alcoholic's blood sugar frequently goes low. I'll kind of hurry over this. And I won't go into the experiments that have shown this, but nonetheless, they're there. It said that our blood pressures are very low at a period of time. For instance, a person awakens in the morning. Now, I'm talking about the sober alcoholic. His blood pressure is low. His blood sugar is low. He feels irritable, tense, nervous, irascible, fullness in the head, not quite with it. And he gets out the big book and tries to read it, or gets out some AA literature and tries to read it. Doesn't make any sense. He throws the book in the corner. He wants to tear up the literature, and he says, I'm off the program. Well, he actually isn't off the program. He's just a little hungry, and his blood pressure is still a little low. And if he only would do it, if he could get himself to eat and exercise, he'd feel a little better. The very reverse of what he wants to do, but nonetheless, this is true. Then it said that the alcoholic's fluid requirements are high. The non-alcoholic looks on in dumb amazement at our injudicious slurping of fluid. You know, coffee and water and orange juice and tea, and we just put things into our great fat mouths constantly. The incidence of baldness, oddly. Baldness is less amongst alcoholics. We have bald alcoholics, of course. This statistic, every time I get up in the morning and look in the mirror, I tend to doubt this statistic. But it said that the incidence of baldness is less amongst alcoholics. The incidence of obesity, fatness, is less amongst alcoholics. We have fat alcoholics, but on the other hand, the incidence is lower. I recall some years ago I stepped outside of my surgical specialty and addressed, 4,000 or 5,000 general practitioners at the Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles on alcoholism, and told them what I'm telling you now, but in, you know, words this long, you know, that sort of thing. And I told them about these rather humorous observations, that the alcoholic was usually thin and heavy head of hair and so on. The next morning, the only thing that was quoted in every radio in the country and in every newspaper was that I had said that if you're thin and have a heavy head of hair and you're thirsty, look out. Muscle tension in alcoholics at rest is higher than in non-alcoholics. The alcoholic is also given to kind of a black and white way of living. You know, the non-alcoholic goes out and cuts his lawn, and then he sees a bird, and he looks at the beautiful, where the feathers lay one upon the other, and the colors. And his wife comes out and says, "Dear, won't you please cut the lawn?" And he cuts a little while longer. And then he sees a flower, and he looks at it and savors its beauty and the way it opens up and its loveliness. And then his wife comes out and says, "The lawn." So he cuts a little farther, and then he goes to a hedge, and he sees his friend across the hedge, and they engage about the World Series or whatnot. And finally he gets the lawn cut, and very well. But it's a rather easy-going sort of a maneuver. Next door are you and I, flat on our back, doing nothing. And all of a sudden we decide to cut the lawn, and it's cut just like that, and we're back on our, flat on our backs again. So the oscillations of motivation tend to vary in the alcoholic a little bit. So there are many things here that this act. We could go on to a variety of other things about metabolism and sugars and whatnot, but just forget it. Now, the X factor then, which is either born in the person or he acquires it, when added to alcohol, create alcoholism. Now, lest you get the idea that I am stating that alcohol creates alcoholism, I don't mean to say this. Alcohol does not create alcoholism any more than gasoline creates habitual auto accidents. Yes, it's a necessary ingredient, but it takes a unique body in order to develop this remarkable disease. So the X factor is what we're going to talk about. Now, because alcohol, you see, alcohol, inhibitions are alcohol soluble. People that are non-alcoholics go to cocktail parties and they drink and their inhibitions subside and tongues loosen up and they become loquacious and friendly and talk and the great libation, perhaps one of the saviors of the human race, except for us. Well, inhibitions drop off, tensions drop off, the person feels better, but the alcoholic takes a drink. He's never had a drink before in his life, and he takes a drink, and his drop-off in tension is fabulous. It's as though suddenly the sky had opened up and God had reached down and said, "Here is some golden fluid for my son of whom I am justly proud." And life becomes grand and glorious. Well, it gets a little better for the non-alcoholic, too, but not this much. As a result, the alcoholic, because of this X factor, if this theory makes any sense, returns to alcohol more often. And the reason he does is that alcohol does something for him. It really makes life grand. It is the one thing that takes away the horrible misery and the pain of sobriety. Suddenly life is all right. Suddenly life is great. Suddenly life is glorious. But it wears off. That's the trouble. So we've got to go back and get some more. Well, over the course of time, the alcoholic becomes dependent on alcohol. And anyone who becomes dependent on a substance builds up a tolerance to it, meaning that the body can tolerate more. When you hear about the hollow leg of the alcoholic, it's true. The alcoholic literally can stand more, can drink more. Now, this isn't true of all alcoholics. There are some alcoholics whose tolerance is always low. They get drunk on a few drinks. But it's what the alcohol does to them, nonetheless. Well, and in the very end of alcoholism, the tolerance drops off. But for most of the duration of the disease of alcoholism, every time the alcoholic drinks, his tolerance increases until, on, let's say, that given day, he needs that much alcohol to give him the same effect that this much alcohol used to give him. Same is true with a morphine addict. He may start off with an eighth of a grain and finally require 3 or 4 grains a day to get the same effect because his tolerance has built up, his need for it. So make no bones about it. Every day that the alcoholic continues to drink, the next day he requires just a little bit more to get the same effect. Now, this progression may be slow, or indeed it may be rapid. Now, this reminds me when I said late in the game that the tolerance dropped off. Now, let me say this, that we in AA do not represent the alcoholic population in any sense of the word. We are people, many of us, who have had a good deal of trouble. Not all of us, but many of us. The vast majority of alcoholics do not have great trouble. As a matter of fact, 97% of alcoholics are alcoholics with assets. We had an old story in AA some years ago that we drank and thought we fooled our friends. And all of a sudden we realized we hadn't been fooling people at all. Now, for some in this room, this may be true. But for the vast majority of current-day alcoholics, they do fool their friends. They are successful in fooling their friends. And here's where AA is falling flat on its face these days, because the texture of the drunk that's coming to AA is different than we used to be. He is having less trouble. It's hard for him to lay back and to follow the 12 steps. He has questions. He wants to question all these things, and it's up to us to slowly keep up with the times, which we are not doing. We must do so in order for us to continue to build, but I won't get off on that tangent. Only 3% of alcoholics are on Skid Row. 97% of alcoholics are alcoholics with incomes, homes, families, money, and taking the alcoholics as a whole. Now, this is a big thing to do, but well over half of the alcoholic's friends and acquaintances have no concept that he has any trouble with booze. I just wanted to get that point across, because this is changing, you see. This didn't used to be true, but this is really indeed changing these days. Well, let's go on here about this progression of alcoholism. So the alcoholic, then, he builds up a tolerance to alcohol, and this continues to go all the time as long as he continues to drink. Now, if we can just digress for a minute, we'll say this is a bucket. And let's compare that to the body, and let's pour into this bucket a half ounce of whiskey per hour, or 8 ounces of beer per hour. If one did this, one would not get drunk. Now, anyone in this room who is an alcoholic who is stupid enough to go out and try this will find himself saying, "What good is 8 ounces of beer per hour?" Indeed, what good is a half ounce of whiskey per hour? This is ridiculous. So pretty soon, any one of you who try this, if you're nutty enough, do it, you will finally find that perhaps you're drinking 4 ounces of whiskey per hour. But if you do, I guarantee you that only 3.5 ounces of that 4 will be involved in getting you drunk. The other half ounce is burned up, and so on. So that what good then? The non-alcoholic can do this fine. He can continually take a half ounce of whiskey per hour, burn it up, he never gets drunk at all. You see? Not the alcoholic. His tolerance is high. It's going up and up and up, and his absolute physical need for alcoholism increases each day. He's got to have a fluid balance into his body. He's got to get a lot of booze in here to satisfy this ever-increasing tolerance before alcohol has its desired effect. Well, as he pours more of this delicious slop into his body, he develops a series of symptoms, and I'm going to put them down on the board. The first one is gulping. Gulping. Now, nothing drives the alcoholic more to distraction than go to a cocktail party and see a non-alcoholic who really knows how to drink. You see, the one thing that we know how to do well is how to drink booze badly. The non-alcoholic will take a martini to his or her lips and have the temerity to sip it. You know? And then this drives the alcoholic to distraction, because his immediate reaction as the non-alcoholic, who really knows how to drink, sips it, he says to himself, "Why in God's name don't you knock that thing off?" You know? And then the non-alcoholic has the temerity to sip the sipped drink down again and let it sit there. Well, this is not in the kin of the alcoholic. He must gulp his drinks. He's got to get enough into his body so he'll feel something. He becomes victimized by this ever-increasing tolerance. I recall one time my daughter and I, this was some years ago, we're going back east and we're going to see a play in New York, and this was part of a business trip I was making. And I happened to read in the newspaper about 2 months before we left that there was an actor going to New York to rehearse for a play in which he was to play the part of an alcoholic. And he said in the article, he was interviewed by Payne Knickerbocker, or I don't know, somebody in the one of the papers, and he said that he had himself had a problem with alcohol but no longer drank. Didn't say he was a member of AA, just said that he no longer drank. So I thought, well, I'm going to see how this fellow acts on the stage as an alcoholic. So I went back, and 2 months had passed, and we're finally in the audience, and the opening of the play, and I couldn't wait to see how this fellow handled his stage booze. He first came out in the set, and he poured a big slug of booze, and opened his great big gullet, and knocked it on. I said, that's my boy. I could tell this fellow really understood and knew how to go. Now, the next thing is, Sneaking drinks. This is, the alcoholic is always around the source of supply. And as I have said, 97% of alcoholics are alcoholics with assets, so they are around the source of supply. The alcoholic's out here in the kitchen, and he makes the drinks on a tray. His, of course, is much stronger with a couple extra belts in it because he has to have it. He doesn't realize that he's drinking more. He just is drinking more. He just somehow slops a little extra into his glass until it gets more and more and more because he has to have it, or else why drink? That's why people go to a cocktail party and the amount of alcohol that's supplied is unsatisfying. The alcoholic can't stay there. He's got to leave and get off and go someplace. He otherwise die, or why drink, you know? Well, so he makes the drinks, and his is stronger, and then he takes these into the people in the living room and serves them. And one day, when his tolerance is increasing enough, he discovers a little glass it holds about 3 ounces. It's very thick. You drop it on the floor, and it won't break. He keeps it up behind some plates on a shelf. He's mixing the drinks. His, by this time, is much stronger on another night. He reaches up and gets his glass, pours out a big slug, and knocks it off, and then he takes the tray of drinks into the people in the living room. Well, this is fine until one day he's doing it again. Pours out his extra drink. His is already on the tray and is much stronger. Pours out an extra drink and is about to knock it off when a non-alcoholic walks in and says, what are you doing that for? And the alcoholic says, I don't know. It just somehow seemed like a good idea. Somehow to take that extra drink. And the non-alcoholic says, well, you've got one on the tray. What are you doing that kind of business for? Really? No, actually, why I do this? An alcoholic walks out, and he belts off the drink, and he decides that this is something that's frowned on. He's doing something that isn't supposed to be done. So gloomily, he takes the drinks into the company, and he starts to worry. The next time he's mixing drinks, he's here at the tray, at the counter with the tray on it, making his own drink, and this one much stronger. He reaches for the glass and thinks, oh my God, someone might come in. So he looks out quick, comes back in, fills the glass, knocks it off, and then takes the tray out like this. The trick is to do this and not get caught. This is sneaking drink. Well, if we put the following formula on the board, we might be able to understand another factor. Let's say this E standing for surgical ether. If you add it to surgical ether under appropriate chemical conditions, a molecule of water, you know, H2O, one would then have alcohol. So alcohol and ether are identical, except for this very minor difference. Well, as a result, the alcoholic whose tolerance is high and going up, he is taking into his body a great deal of ether, fundamentally. Of course, it's now alcohol, but it's fundamentally ether. So he puts to sleep the frontal lobes of his brain where consciousness is located, as we think about it, and he goes into what are known as blackouts.
Now, why doesn't he pass out? Well, the reason he doesn't pass out is that his tolerance is so high that he can tolerate this vast amount of alcohol. His tolerance has increased and increased, and this is the crux of the situation. It's ever-increasing tolerance all the time. The ever-increasing tolerance on one hand and social disapproval on the other. The alcoholic always tries to bring these two together, but he never succeeds. It's a lost cause. The non-alcoholic, were he to attempt to do this, because his tolerance is not high, he gets sick and vomits and goes home and he wakes up the next morning feeling like death warmed over. And, you know, alcoholics rarely have hangovers early in the game. I'm not talking about the dry heaves now. I'm talking about the typical syndrome of awakening with headaches and not being able to go to work early in the game. The alcoholic has a high tolerance to chemicals. Even to start with, he is born with this. In the history of alcoholics, we find that often as children, they could tolerate a great deal of anesthetics while they're having their tonsils taken out. It's true in my own case and many other cases where we've gotten satisfactory histories. This long before they ever had a drink, you understand. They were born with a high tolerance to chemicals. Well, the alcoholic can drink a great deal early in his drinking game and get up and shake his head and go off to work. Well, the non-alcoholic is flat on his back because he hasn't got this built-in tendency, whatever it is. So anyway, we have then blackouts that occur. You know, nothing is worse than awakening and driving down the highway and being sufficiently removed from the source of alcoholic supply and suddenly having the anesthetic wear off and you're behind the wheel of a moving automobile having no idea how you got there. Or waking up in strange towns or strange beds or so forth. So, toxic dependent drinking, this is known as, with slipping control. Slipping control. Now, slipping control means that once the alcoholic starts to drink, it's not guaranteed that he will remember to stop. That his, he may forget to stop if something happens to him. Now, there are those who say that the alcoholic in this early stage might stay sober all by himself and not come to such an organization as AA. The big book, on the other hand, says in about page 42 in this second edition that the potential alcoholic or the real alcoholic, with rarely an exception, cannot stay sober without spiritual help. So it's likely that the person who has these early symptoms might have some difficulty, or at least not be as amiable about his sobriety as he would if he came to an organization such as AA. Now we get into another dangerous symptom, and this is inappropriate drunkenness. This is where there's a boss coming, you know, for the night, or some important personage, or they're going to a banquet where it's vital that proper decorum be maintained, and suddenly the alcoholic says, I guess I won't drink tonight. I tend to sometimes overdo it. But then he inevitably says, oh well, I'll have just two. And then he wakens the next morning from a blackout, you see. I remember a friend of mine named Clark Billingsley. I remember Clark. And he was a butcher, great help to me in the early days of AA. Never missed a day of work, but he was just drunk all day long. And his wife was worried about this business. He would go home, he'd buy a half pint of whiskey, he'd uncork it, get to the bottom of his stairs and take a couple of drinks out of it and put the cork in and put it back in his pocket. Then he'd go up the stairs and start to go in the door, and Jane, his wife, would be waiting. She would open the door and reach out and grab him by the coat and pull him in and smell his breath and say, oh, Clark, you've been drinking again. And he would say, oh, no, Jane, I've just had two drinks. And he was right. He had just had two drinks. So I'll just have two drinks. And then he awakens from a blackout. He's insulted the boss. He's made a fool of himself. This getting drunk, he's forgotten to stop, you see. I remember This was about 5 or 6 years ago. I was at the family club on Powell Street in San Francisco with a doctor friend of mine, and they were playing dominoes. I never understood why people play dominoes, but he did, and he liked these dominoes, and so I sat and watched. I was his guest, and they fed him three old-fashioned. You know, all these glasses that are, you can almost take a bath in them, you know, that kind of a glass. And I could see that he was getting just a little bit tipsy by his talk and the way he... And so the bartender came to him and said, Doctor, wouldn't you like another drink? And he said, Oh, no, I've had enough. This is enough for me. And I had the strangest sensation. My God, I've been out of there long ago. I've been sober for years, but I thought, all of a sudden I was carried along in what was happening, you see. And to see this fellow suddenly come to you, perfectly fine, non-alcoholic, he knew when he had had enough. We don't remember this, you see. That's the point. So inappropriate drunkenness. Then about this time, the alcoholic has the beginning of an emotional symptom which is destined to plague him forevermore. There's nothing that describes this symptom. Dread doesn't describe it, or terror doesn't describe it, or awe doesn't describe it. It's the most penetrating, the most exasperating, this is all understatement, feeling that is imaginable. And this is the gruesome feeling of remorse. Remorse fills the alcoholic more than, it's absolutely indescribable. Remorse. And then about this time, the alcoholic develops the shakes and sweats, you know, the whips and jingles. We call it the S plus S, we'll put down here. Which reminds me of a story of a very famous jazz guitar player and a jazz clarinetist who were in a bar, both alcoholics, and trying to get a drink up to their lips, you know, and they were spilling it, and it was all over the bar, and the glass would fall out of their hands. And bartender, you know, they're gracious souls. Very patiently wiping it up and filling the glass again, and then they try to get it up their lips, and it would spill, and all the glass was down again. And after this delightful physical maneuver had been going on for some time, a non-alcoholic walked in and was stopped dead in his tracks because he saw this. And he watched them spill several glasses. And then he withdrew for a bit, and he said, Gentlemen, he said, I don't mean to interrupt here, but he said, I'm kind of interested. He said, what profession are you two engaged in? And in typical resentful fashion, the banjo or the guitar player looked up at him and studied him for a minute, and he said, I'm a brain surgeon. My friend here is a watchmaker, you know. Filling the drink. Shake. Then the alcohol, no one knows why the shakes and sweats occur. Maybe it's an upset in fluid balance. Maybe it's due to certain enzyme systems being upset. There's a vast number of theories. But all of the authorities are agreed that at least half of the reason that the alcoholic has the shakes and sweats is he's scared half to death of what's happening to him. So shakes and sweats. Then the alcoholic makes a glorious discovery. He says, oh, if I just had a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit me, I would be fine. So he takes a drink and up it comes like this, right back up again. And he goes through a period. But nonetheless, he keeps this down finally, and all of the shakes and sweats disappear, all of the remorse disappears, and he feels absolutely at one with God again. The morning drink, the only trouble is he can't function very well. But, so he has the A.M. drink, and this becomes his constant companion. Now, by the way, there are many alcoholics who never had a morning drink in their lives. Never had a drink before 5 p.m. in their lives. And incidentally, as I put down these symptoms, as you might say to yourself, well, I haven't had trouble like you were describing all along this line. I just think I drink a little bit too much. I haven't had much trouble with booze. I say to you, have hope, you will. Because the more that the alcoholic continues to drink, and the more his tolerance increases, the more he must drink, and make no bones about it, the more he must drink. He has to maintain himself, the more symptoms he develops. Then he develops rationalization. Someone says, aren't you drinking more than you used to? And he says, well, yes, I'm strong, but I can stand it. And the woman says, I may be small, brother, but I'm potent. So, rationalization occurs. And then the alcoholic develops malnutrition. 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 For instance, now, if we were to take this formula up here, this, well, let's move this. Remember I said ether plus water equals alcohol. Or let's say alcohol plus carbon dioxide. That's the air we exhale. Two molecules of carbon dioxide, CO2, equals table sugar. So table sugar and alcohol and ether are identical except for these very minor chemical differences. As a result, the alcoholic who is drinking more and more and more and more, because he has to, is getting lots of calories, but no protein, no vitamins, no mineral equivalents, no fat, so he goes into malnutrition and all of those symptoms that can occur. And then he develops insomnia. Insomnia. You know, for a long time, the alcoholic awakens in the morning or at night. He's sleepless. He takes a drink and back to sleep he goes. And he awakens, takes another drink, and back to sleep he goes. And on and off, this tends to go over the course of time. But like all sedatives, they usually reverse their action. So that one night he takes a drink and he's wider awake. And in desperation, he takes two or three more and he's wider awake yet. It stimulates him. It's like some people who take a warm bath and are stimulated. It's like some people who take phenobarbital. And by the way, sedatives are dynamite for us. We should avoid them like the plague. Now, there's certain exceptions. You see, we have drunk up our right for chemical peace of mind. We have drunk up our right for chemical peace of mind. That's all right. Now, there are exceptions. We, after all, have epileptic alcoholics who need certain kinds of medications. And we have certain alcoholics who have high blood pressure. There are certain exceptions to this. But if you are looking for a release from the tensions of life, you're out of luck. You just have to take them on the nose. Only the non-alcoholic can have the benefit of release of tensions with sedatives. We have drunk up our right for this if we want to stay sober or if we don't want to get hooked on pills. Now, I don't mean to upset people here who might be taking pills for one reason or another, but I still say that if you're taking pills so that you will feel more glorious, you're on the wrong track, I promise you. Well, we might go on here. There's one symptom that develops, and that is the symptom of resentment. Nothing gets us into trouble more than this resentment. Now, all people feel resentment, but the resentment I'm talking about has a different texture than the usual resentment. There's nothing that's more vicious. This is why we get ourselves into trouble with the world. We're so vicious. We're so totally unreasonable. Now, these are symptoms which are produced because of the intake of alcohol. We become toxic, just like we had the flu or pneumonia. You know, I operate on people every day, and I notice that the first day or two or three after surgery, their personalities are different. They're toxic. They're getting well. A day or two or three, they're on their way towards recovery, and the old personality returns. They have developed a toxic personality, different. So this resentment, the texture of this resentment, the viciousness of it defies description. We aren't to be blamed for this. This is what happens to the alcoholic, you know. And then there's a symptom that we develop which fascinates the alcoholic. It fascinates him. It's akin to the symptom of when you see a live wire, you think, what would it be like if I just touched it once, you know. Or you're on the top of a building and you think, I might jump, you know, just might go. Well, there's a fascination about these various dangers. And this symptom fascinates the alcoholic. He becomes addicted to it. He loves to pour buckets over his body and rub it in his hair, and this is self-pity.
Ha 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 ha!